You're listening to Radio Hangar, where the aviation conversation never stops. This is The Hangar, I'm Tail Dragger. And today, friends, we are going to talk about the man who might just be the greatest stick and rudder pilot who ever lived. I don't say that lightly. I've been around this game a long time. I've watched thousands of hours of airshow flying. I've sat in cockpits with some incredibly talented people. But when you say the name Bob Hoover to any pilot worth their logbook, something changes in their eyes. There's a reverence there. A quiet acknowledgement that this man operated on a level the rest of us can only dream about. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. So, Robert A. Hoover, born in Nashville, Tennessee, 1922. And here's what you need to understand about Bob right from the start. This was a kid who was so desperate to fly that he soloed at age 15 years old. He got himself to Berry Field, which is now Nashville International, and he talked his way into a cockpit. The way Bob told it later, flying wasn't something he chose, it chose him. He said he couldn't remember a time when he didn't want to be in the air. When the war came, Bob enlisted. He became a fighter pilot flying Spitfires with the 52nd Fighter Group in North Africa and the Mediterranean. Now here's where the story takes a turn that sounds like something out of a movie. On February 9, 1944, Bob was shot down over southern France. His Spitfire took hits and he went down. He was captured by German forces and spent 16 months as a prisoner of war in Stalag Luft 1, a Luftwaffe-run prison camp near the Baltic coast. Now most men would have been broken by that experience. Bob Hoover escaped. Let that sink in for a second. He didn't just survive. He escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And he didn't escape on foot and hide in a barn. No. Bob Hoover stole an airplane. He got out of the camp, made his way to a nearby airfield, found a damaged Focke-Wulf 190 sitting there, and he flew it to safety. He flew an enemy fighter aircraft he had never been trained on, had never sat in before, across hostile territory, and landed at a Dutch airfield held by Allied forces. That right there would be enough for a lifetime of stories. But for Bob Hoover, that was just the prologue. After the war, Bob became a test pilot. He was the backup pilot for Chuck Yeager on the Bell X-1 program, the program that broke the sound barrier. Yeager himself, a man not exactly known for handing out compliments freely, called Bob Hoover the greatest pilot he ever saw. Think about that. Chuck Yeager, the man who broke the sound barrier. And he's pointing at Bob Hoover and saying, "That guy is better than me." Now here's where it gets interesting. Because all of that, the combat, the escape, the test flying, that's not what made Bob Hoover a legend in the eyes of the airshow world. What made Bob Hoover immortal was what he did with a yellow Aero Commander Shrike. Pull up a chair for this one, because if you never saw Bob Hoover fly an airshow, I need to paint this picture for you. Imagine you're standing on the ramp at Oshkosh, or Reno, or any of 100 airshows across this country. The announcer says his name, and there's this electric feeling that runs through the crowd. You look up and here comes this twin-engine business airplane, a Shrike Commander, an airplane that was designed to haul salesmen and their briefcases from one regional airport to another. It was not designed to do aerobatics. It was emphatically not designed to do what Bob Hoover was about to do with it. He'd come across the field and shut down one engine, just feather the prop and let it windmill to a stop. And then he'd do a roll, a beautiful, graceful barrel roll in a twin-engine airplane on one engine. The crowd would go nuts. And then while they were still cheering, he'd shut down the other engine, both engines off, dead stick, in a Shrike Commander. And then he would fly an entire aerobatic routine, rolls, loops, eight-point rolls, all of it with no power whatsoever. He was flying on nothing but energy management, pure absolute mastery of altitude, airspeed and gravity. He knew exactly how much energy he had in that airplane at every single moment. He knew how much a roll would cost him. He knew how much a loop would take. And he budgeted that energy like a miser counting gold coins, spending just enough on each maneuver and saving just enough for the next one. And then after this impossible sequence of aerobatics in a dead airplane, he would set up for landing. Still no engines. He'd come around the pattern, touch down on the runway, and roll out to the precise spot on the ramp where he wanted to park. Not close to the spot, the spot. He'd stop that airplane exactly where the ground crew was standing, every single time. The precision was otherworldly. Pilots in the crowd, guys with tens of thousands of hours, would just stand there shaking their heads because we all understood what we were seeing. We understood the margins he was operating in. One miscalculation, one gust of wind he didn't account for, one maneuver that cost him 10 feet more altitude than he planned, and the whole thing comes apart. There's no going around. There's no adding power. The engines are off. You get one shot. And Bob never missed.
Now, there's a detail about his routine that I think captures the man better than anything else. During the energy management demonstration, while he was flying that dead stick Shrike Commander through aerobatic maneuvers, Bob would have a glass of iced tea sitting on the instrument panel glare shield. Some folks say it was a glass of water. Bob himself usually called it iced tea, whatever was in that glass. Here's the point. He would fly the airplane so smoothly, with such perfectly coordinated control inputs, that the tea would not spill. He'd do a roll, a full 360 roll, and the glass would stay right there on the glare shield. The liquid would stay in the glass, not because of some trick or some special holder, because his coordination was so perfect that the G-forces kept everything exactly where it was. The airplane rotated around the glass of tea, and the tea never knew the difference. I've talked to pilots who saw that for the first time, and they'll tell you it changed the way they thought about flying. It wasn't about force. It wasn't about wrestling the airplane. It was about finesse, about understanding the physics so deeply that you could make a 7,000-pound airplane move through three-dimensional space as gently as rocking a baby to sleep. Bob also flew a P-51 Mustang in his airshow act, called it Old Yeller because of its bright yellow paint scheme, and if the Shrike Commander routine was poetry, the Mustang routine was rock and roll. He'd come screaming across the field at 300 miles an hour, pull up into a perfect Cuban 8, roll off the top, and come back down with that Merlin engine howling like a banshee. The sound alone would rattle your chest. That big four-blade prop chewing through the air, the exhaust stacks barking on every cylinder. But even in the Mustang, what set Bob apart was the precision. Every maneuver flowed into the next one. There was no wasted motion, no unnecessary energy spent. It was like watching a maestro conduct a symphony, where the orchestra was a 1,500 horsepower Rolls-Royce Merlin engine, and the concert hall was the open sky.
Back when Avgas was cheap and airspace was free, air shows were a little wilder than they are today. But even by the standards of that era, Bob Hoover was in a class by himself. The other airshow pilots knew it. They'd finish their own routines and then park their airplanes and go stand on the ramp to watch Bob fly. That tells you everything you need to know. Now, I'd be leaving out an important part of the story if I didn't talk about what happened in 1992. The Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, pulled Bob's medical certificate. He was 70 years old. There were questions raised after an incident about whether age was affecting his abilities. Bob fought it, he fought it hard, and the aviation community rallied around him. Pilots, doctors, aviation organizations, they all stood up and said, "This is wrong." Jimmy Doolittle wrote a letter on Bob's behalf. The case went through administrative hearings, and ultimately Bob got his medical back. But the whole episode left a mark on the community. It raised real questions about how we evaluate pilot competency, about whether bureaucratic standards can ever really measure what a pilot like Bob Hoover brings to the cockpit. The FAA was doing its job the way the rules told it to, but sometimes the rules don't have a box to check for genius. Bob kept flying air shows into his 70s. He finally retired from air show performing in 2000. He passed away on October 25, 2016. He was 94 years old. "I want to leave you with something," Bob said once in an interview. He said, "Fly the airplane as far into the crash as possible." Now that sounds dark, but what he meant was this: never give up on the airplane, never stop flying. As long as that machine is moving through the air, you're a pilot and you have options. Don't freeze, don't quit. Fly it all the way. That philosophy is what got him through a shootdown over France, through a stolen Focke-Wulf, through decades of test flying and airshow performing with margins thinner than a cigarette paper. Fly the airplane as far into the crash as possible. If that's not the most Bob Hoover thing ever said, I don't know what is. Today's stories drew from accounts published by the Experimental Aircraft Association, the Air Force Test Center History Archives, and numerous interviews Bob gave over the years to aviation journalists and historians. If you want to dig deeper, his autobiography, Forever Flying, is worth every page. This program is AI-generated content, created by folks who love flying just as much as the people we talk about. You can find more at radiohangar.com. That's it for the hangar today. I'm Taildragger. Go find an old pilot, buy him a cup of coffee, ask him about the time he saw Bob Hoover fly. I promise you, the story will be worth it. Radio Hangar, keep the blue side up.